From the Hmong Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. In 2016, LA voters approved over $1 billion to build permanent housing for the homeless. 3 years later, no units have been built, and a city audit suggests shifting money to shelters instead. Plus, up and down the coast, the state of California recommends beach communities back away from the ocean when sea levels rise. We'll hear why one city is saying, no, we're staying right on the water. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for choosing us on a Tuesday. Take Two Tuesday. There you go. You can use that. It's all yours. Coming up later on today's show, we're going to find out more about the Santa Ana winds, which are expected to kick in this Thursday. The state's main utilities are on high alert. More on that in about 15 minutes. But we're going to start today with homelessness. And a new report that says shovels in the ground to build more housing in LA are moving way too slowly. This audit comes from City Controller Ron Galperin, who looked into the $1.2 billion from Measure Triple H. Voters passed that proposition 3 years ago to pay for the construction of 10,000 housing units for homeless people. But in his report, he says the city can now only afford to build 3/4 of that original goal. And so far, zero have opened.
And am very concerned about the path that the city has taken so far in terms of performance on this much-needed housing.
That's LA Controller Ron Galperin on KPCC's Air Talk earlier today. Now we'll get reaction from City Hall. With us now is Christina Miller, LA's Deputy Mayor for City Homelessness Initiatives. Christina, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, what's your first reaction to this report?
Well, I mean, I think the controller does a good job of outlining the fact that this is complicated work and that there really isn't any silver bullet to solving homelessness. But again, we always appreciate the partnership of his office and the deep dive he took on the complex industry of developing affordable housing.
All right, so let's get to those perspectives. Because according to the audit of that $1.2 billion for Measure HHH, there are zero units to show for it. Why?
Building affordable housing and supportive housing from the ground up is not something that happens overnight. A construction period on average can take up to 18 months. These are not buildings that are stood up overnight. And that's something we already knew. We are aware that building Triple H was never going to be the emergency response to homelessness. It is building out quality city infrastructure for years and generations to come. What I will say is that when Triple H was passed, the city passed an accompanying ordinance called the Permanent Supportive Housing Ordinance, or the PSHO. And what this ordinance aimed to do was to cut down the pre-development time and the timeline that it takes to stand up buildings. Unfortunately, that ordinance is held up in litigation. So, you know, we haven't been able to apply it to the projects that we have in our pipeline right now. But we are, cautiously optimistic that we will have some relief soon and that the case will be dismissed. And we can start seeing the relief that that ordinance would have offered.
When city leaders first pitched the idea for Triple H, they said the maximum estimated cost to build a unit was $414,000. Now, the median price tag is $531,000. As the city's chief accountant, Ron Galperin, crunched the numbers, here he is on Air Talk again.
The cost of these units is in excess of the typical condo in the city of LA, in excess of the typical house in the county of Los Angeles in some cases.
Christina, why does it cost so much more?
What I want to make sure listeners understand is that the city itself is not actually paying the total development cost. We are subsidizing just a portion of the development costs, and on average for the HHH subsidies, we're looking at around $150,000 per apartment. But what I will say is, you know, we are in a sizzling hot construction market. Labor is expensive. Land is expensive. Materials, raw materials to build buildings are expensive. I'll also say that while things are expensive, we're not going to stop in an effort to wait to see if the market will cool down. That's not an option.
Last year, the private nonprofit organization AIDS Healthcare Foundation bought a hotel in Skid Row, converted it to homeless housing, and the organization said it only cost them $130,000 per unit. Why does it cost you maybe three or four times that to get the same result?
Building from the ground up is sometimes more costly than renovating an existing building. I think what's important for people to understand is that the Triple H program is not the only program that the city is implementing to combat homelessness. We are in the process of rehabbing existing buildings. We are in the process of going full throttle with our Triple H program. We are also in the process of implementing our what we think of as the in the meantime approach, where we're standing up shelters and bridge housing projects all over the city as an interim stopgap solution to people who are literally homeless on the streets right now.
Talking to Christina Miller, LA's Deputy Mayor for City Homelessness Initiatives. Now, as each day and month goes by, the homeless problem in Los Angeles gets worse. The report suggests finding ways to fast-track the building of housing units. How do you get there, Christina?
We appreciate the recommendations in the Comptroller's report. We also are happy to say that we've already put a lot of the recommendations underway. For example, the Mayor's Executive Directive 13 instructs departments to streamline and prioritize the permitting process of affordable and supportive housing developments. We're also really excited that AB 1197 was passed by the state and signed by the governor last week, which allows more CEQA exemptions, or allows these projects to be exempt from what can often be lengthy and expensive environmental reviews, which is often used as a weapon just to slow down homeless housing. So we are, you know, the mayor is 100% committed to finding what these streamlining measures look like and get the units out the door quicker.
Last time we spoke, it was so we could have a tour of some of the new bridge housing for homeless people, sort of launch pad shelters for people to get off the streets first before they head into a permanent home. But if this effort, Christina, continues to move slowly and permanent homes are not being built fast enough, does that in some ways sabotage other efforts and other solutions?
What I'll say is this. Last year, we saw an increase in the permanent housing placement that was more than doubled the numbers we had seen just a few years ago. We are building a system that works and bringing solutions online as quickly as we possibly can. What the challenge will now be as we look forward is how to scale our solutions to match the scale and the magnitude of the crisis on the streets.
One last thing, Christina. For a voter out there who voted for Measure HHH and is listening and is thinking, is the mayor's office really on top of this problem? What do you say?
I would say 100% yes. We need your help. We need you to continue to be part of the solutions as well. I'll also say if there's any landlords out there or if any Angelenos who voted for Triple H know any landlords, that's also something we're really interested in doing, which is bolstering our relationships with people who have vacant units who will accept the homeless service programs that we have on the market today.
That's Christina Miller, LA's Deputy Mayor for City Homelessness Initiatives. Christina, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Permanent solutions to help and house all of LA County's nearly 59,000 homeless may seem far off, given what you just heard, especially when, according to the LA Times, 67% struggle with mental illness or substance abuse. But a handful of concerned residents and county officials see a glimmer of hope, a successful model for care that can be found in northern Italy. 2 weeks ago, a delegation took one of several trips to the city of Trieste. There, they observed the results of a patient-based program that has taken nearly all people with mental illness off the streets. That's right, off the streets. Now, members of that group hope to bring those practices here and start a pilot program in Hollywood. Carrie Morrison is one of the people working on the pilot. She's with me now. Carrie, thanks for coming on Take Two.
So appreciate being here to talk with you today.
Before this trip, you were part of the Business Improvement District in Hollywood for years, and then you made a big shift. For you personally, what did you see in your community that led you to move in the direction of volunteering and policymaking?
So 10 years ago, managing the BID, I started there in the late 90s. I was noticing that the homeless situation was becoming more challenging. And I came to the conclusion that the business community actually had to get involved in this issue. This was not something that was going to be solved by government or social service providers, that this had to be an all hands on deck situation.
Is that what business does typically? They look to the city and say, fix it.
I think that's what a lot of my property owners said, like, move these people out of here, fix this problem. Why? What's happening? This is not what we were set up to do as a business improvement district. But as I became more involved and cognizant of how challenging and how complicated homelessness is, just because of the variety of ways in which people end up in this state, I became more and more involved.
To the point where it became your life.
It was hard to fit all that work into the margins. I was appointed to the LASA Commission. I'm on the Triple H Committee. But what happened is that back in 2013, our coalition, you know, we had made progress. We had been able to attract housing resources into Hollywood. We were making some progress. But there was a small cohort of people, the most severely mentally ill, that remained in, on the same bus bench that they had sat on for 10 years or in the same alley. And we made a list on the wall, and we called that the Hollywood Top 14. It was supposed to be 10, but everybody wanted to add four more names. So we began to work that list. Like, why is it so hard to help these people get off the street and into a safer place to live?
Because things weren't changing for them.
Things were not changing for them. Some of these folks had been on the streets for over two decades. Severely mentally ill, deteriorating, three people on the original Top 14 list died. So I then began to become a student of our mental health system and came to understand that the system is very dysfunctional, is really not set up to help people who are severely mentally ill, and these folks are just left to languish and die on our streets.
It almost feels like it's treading water at best.
Treading water or just human suffering. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it, human suffering. In 2016, I was awarded a study fellowship. And the commitment was I had to spend 3 months over 2 years to explore any issue that I felt would be of material benefit to Los Angeles if I had the bandwidth to do that. And for the first year, I looked for solutions in the United States. Who's doing it better in the U.S.? I did not find any answers. There's bright spots, but systemically, there was no real answer in the United States. And I was informed about this place in Italy called Trieste. And the World Health Organization has declared that this is the place on planet Earth that shows an exemplary way to treat people in the community who have a mental illness.
So you had to go see it.
I had to go see it. I was traveling to a couple cities in Europe, and I went to Trieste, and I spent 1 day there, and I was blown away. That was in the summer of 2017. I came back to LA, and I thought, my goodness, I've seen something that is amazing. So I reached out to the new director of the Department of Mental Health at that time, Dr. Jonathan Sharon, and I said, look, there's going to be a conference in Trieste in November 2017. I would like to bring some leaders back from LA to see this. You have to see this.
Now, you took a big team out there.
12. Yeah, 12 people. The first time.
What did you see there? What was so unique about what you saw in Trieste that made you want to take this big team there?
In Trieste, when they closed their asylum in 1980, they actually built a system in the community to care for people. So they built 24-hour access community mental health centers. You can walk in at any time and get your needs met. No need for an appointment, no waiting list. Very welcoming, hospitable, non-clinical, non-medical feel, just a community center. They had a central hospital that serves a city of 240,000 people with 6 psych beds, open door, no restraint, and maybe at most 2 were being used for a city of 240,000. In the city, they've divided the city into 4 areas, and those 4 community mental health centers feel complete accountability. So here in America, where we can lose people, they wander away or they fall out of compliance with services. In Italy, they feel accountable for the people who live in their catchment area. But the other thing that was really remarkable was just the cultural way in which people were treated. They were not treated as patients. They were not treated in any kind of hierarchical sense, like I'm the psychiatrist, you're the user. They call them users of the system. I know what's good for you. It was an entirely horizontal relationship. People don't wear uniforms. You don't know who's the clinician, who's the user in the system. Instead of doing case plans and medical records, they will capture a person's life story. Where did you come from? What did you study in school? What do you like to do? And they work with a person to create a life plan. What do you aspire to? What do you want to do in your life? How do we help you get there?
And when it comes to helping individuals rebuild their lives, essentially, how does the community factor in with those who are in treatment?
So they believe in social integration. They're very high on people avoiding isolation and loneliness. And so what they've done in the city is they've created a whole host of opportunities for people to be included in the community. Clubs and associations that people can participate in, gardening, culinary, art, you name it. And they have a very active vocational commitment through a series of what they call social cooperatives. And social cooperatives are ways to employ people with a mental illness in restaurants, hotels. The system in Italy believes that people have the right, the human right, to wake up in the morning and have a sense of purpose to their day. finding purpose and meaning in life is part of the recovery journey. And these are things we don't do in the United States.
We're talking to Carrie Morrison about a proposed pilot program to help mentally ill and homeless people in Hollywood. Now, you're hoping to start that pilot program for a different style of care here in LA, inspired by what you found and what you saw in Italy. But how do you think outcomes could change when these ideas are brought to LA, considering this is a larger city with a lot of different factors at play?
It's such a great question. And what I like to say is that we cannot adopt Italian culture, but we can adapt what is really powerful about their human-centered approach, even in American culture. So what is envisioned for Hollywood, and this was the genius of Dr. Sharon, he knew that there was money at the state level under the Mental Health Services Act.
And Dr. Sharon
is the head of the County Department of Mental Health, that if you could propose to the state a true innovation, it frees up a bucket of money to fund a pilot of this sort. So he hired an excellent consultant, and we went in front of the state board in May with a proposed 5-year pilot in Hollywood in a fairly contained catchment area, La Brea to Vermont, Franklin to Melrose, where we would try to replicate many of these Italian values or variables in that pilot. Now, one of the big innovations that is entailed is that the American system is really a medical system where everything that someone does in the mental health staff client relationship has to be billed back to Medicaid. What we're looking at is freeing up that billing system so that people are given a per capita budget to do whatever it takes to serve the needs of that person at that moment.
Now, with a pilot, you're awaiting county approval for funding, but if the project does indeed move forward, what will it take for you to see success?
There will be an academic partner who will be attached to this to track outcomes, but I think there's going to be system outcomes and individual outcomes that we're going to look for. We will be able to track levels of hospitalization and incarceration, interaction by law enforcement. We don't want law enforcement to be the first responders in Hollywood. In this pilot, we want to have a 24-hour team that will move through the community with a clinician, with a peer, you know, so someone with lived experience that will be the primary interaction to help reduce crises and address situations. So if we can reduce calls into 911, that would be a positive outcome. For the people who we are engaging with, if we can actually get them to a place where they're in a treatment plan that they find acceptable, and if they're housed and they stay housed, and now they start to move on a trajectory of improving their kind of life independence, their skills, their self-sufficiency, those are all things that can be measured.
That's Carrie Morrison talking to us about a proposed pilot program to help mentally ill and homeless people in Hollywood based on a successful program in Italy. Carrie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, up and down the coast, the state of California recommends that beach communities back away from the ocean when sea levels rise. It's called managed retreat. And that's what the California Coastal Commission is there to do, have oversight over land use where the surf meets the turf. However, find out why one Southern California city is saying, no, we're not on board with managed retreat. It does not work for us, and we are staying right on the water. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Santa Ana winds are back, forecast to start Thursday and then blow through Saturday around Southern California. As always, the arrival of the Santa Anas create an extra layer of anxiety in the fall because they increase the risk of wildfire. For more on that, on the what and the why of these so-called devil winds, we've got KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis in the studio. Hello, Jacob.
Hey.
All right, so we know we could have some windy weather, but what other conditions can we expect Thursday and into the weekend?
Yeah, so it's going to be hot. It's going to be dry. Temperatures in the upper 80s, relative humidity around 5 to 10%. My lips are already chapped.
Mine too.
I don't know about,
they have been. Yes,
yeah,
they have.
I can feel it. But they're also going to bring red flag warnings because obviously, as you said, high winds, dry conditions, fires.
Now, okay, so there is also the risk of winds bringing down power lines, and that's why the state's two main utilities could shut off power in counties all over the state, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a possibility with SoCal Edison. You know, possibly 100,000 people could go without power. For PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, they will proactively start to shut down power to potentially 800,000 homes in Central and Northern California, starting possibly just after midnight on Wednesday. And the big question is why? Well, we mentioned fire, and to bring people back, you know, the Thomas Fire is a great example. Yeah. Investigators determined that it was started, you know, when two lines basically slapped together in high winds, sparks started fires, and the winds just kind of took it all away. And we could see more shutoffs like these as utilities try to protect themselves and people.
Yeah, and generally the Santa Anas, you know, going back decades, have made us all a little bit more jittery around this time of year. Remind us what the Santa Anas are and what conditions create them.
Intense dry winds that flow from the east to the west. That's what's happening this week. We've got a cold front, the high pressure, with high pressure over the Rockies. Winds will be coming basically down from that, flowing towards the ocean. As the cold air picks up speed and drops down our mountains, it actually condenses and it heats up, and we could see gusts up to 60 miles per hour. And they're not unusual between October and March. We're kind of right in the middle of, or right at the tip of Santa Ana season now.
Well, we always think of them as a fall thing, right? They're not really the case.
No. I mean, people might remember that they did precede the Thomas Fire a few years ago, which came along in December. And, you know, for me, I'm kind of waiting to I will feel a little better mm-hmm. when the rainy season actually does come along and kind of tamps down some of the risk.
So, okay. So what areas are going to be most affected? Because some communities will get the brunt while others might barely feel it.
They get hit mostly in the mountains and the valleys. The coast and the LA basin might be a bit protected, but there's a fire weather watch across LA County, Orange County, Riverside, and San Bernardino counties too.
What about the surf? Can we have it expect to affect the surf?
Yeah, offshore. I was glad that you guys asked this, because offshore winds can make a wave better depending on the break. Basically, they hold the wave back a little bit and keep them from breaking, so they become steeper, which can be good for surfing. Though I don't think there are going to be like really good waves going into this weekend. I didn't see any sort of indication of a really good swell or anything like that.
Now, for those who live in areas where the winds are typically strong, any suggestions on what they can do to prepare?
Yeah, I mean, people should be doing this before the Santa Anas come along and before wildfires start. And that's, of course, clearing brush and plants. There's a lot of good resources on LAIS.com, as well as Cal Fire has a lot of good resources to tell you what to do. You need to move anything that'll burn kind of like away from the house if a fire does start. And you got to think about the long-term solutions, like possibly fire-resistant roofing and siding. I mean, you could go major and have like tanks with, I think, foam installed.
Wow,
so that firefighter.
Really?
Yeah, and really what, there are a couple things that you need to make sure of. You need to make sure that the fire, if the brush near your house catches on fire, it's hopefully far away enough that it's not going to hopefully catch your house on fire. But you also need to make space for firefighters, because they need to be able to get in there. And if they see that your house has been properly protected and you've put in that effort and they can easily access it and possibly access like sources like pool water or something like that, I think more likely to save your house. And you should really pay attention to that.
Space for fire. I didn't think of that. Space for firefighters.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And people should also consider getting extra generators.
We've been saying that for a long time. Yeah. I got to admit, I haven't done it.
I'm going to pick up a solar-powered one.
You are, really?
Yeah, I might do for earthquakes and this. I think it's be a good investment.
Yeah, at some point I'm going to have to do that too, because we live here, right?
Absolutely.
All right, that's Jacob Margolis, KPCC science reporter, with a little Santa Ana winds explainer. Jacob, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Away out west, they got a name for rain and wind and fire. The rain is Tess, the fire's Joe, and they call the wind Mariah. Oh, now Mariah blows the stars around and sends the clouds a-flying.
All right, moving on. The California Coastal Commission and the city of Del Mar are at a stalemate over how aggressively the state's city's beaches must plan for sea level rise. The city has decided to stick with plans to protect properties on the coast, restocking sands and installing seawalls to protect infrastructure instead of a strategy called managed retreat. Del Mar is among the first cities in the state to formalize a coastal plan to deal with the effects of climate change, but the agency that oversees land use and public access for state beaches is not having it. We wanted to get into the details, so we spoke with Charles Lester. He's director of the Ocean and Coastal Policy Center at UC Santa Barbara. And we started off by asking him how managed retreat is defined.
You know, managed retreat is, I think, gotten a little oversimplified, and it really is intended to be a process over time. It's really important for people to understand that context and the circumstances really matter. Now, we haven't seen that very much in California yet, although there are places, for example, in Pacifica in Northern California, where the forces of erosion are just too great, and we've had to actually abandon some developments along the shoreline. That what the managed part is referring to is that we want to do that in a way that's intelligent and that's helpful to people, not in a way that is unplanned. The last thing I think that anyone wants is to have people in a place of emergency response or not knowing what to do at the time that they need to do something.
Because that's one of the things, right, Charles? Because land on the coast, a house on the coast typically is very expensive. If you pour a lot of money into it, you don't maybe necessarily want to leave it.
Well, I think that's true for any of us who are homeowners that, you know, we invest in a property and we spend a lot of time fixing that property up and it becomes yours. And so that's a totally normal human response. But yes, when you invest in a shoreline property, you're necessarily investing in a place that is inherently hazardous. And also, importantly, in this case, may impact the public's resources. And when you protect a shoreline property with a seawall, you necessarily impact the beach in front of it. You can't live on the shoreline without probably affecting these issues that are also statewide issues.
Now, we mentioned Del Mar is not on board necessarily with a managed retreat. We spoke with Del Mar City Councilman Dwight Warden, and he said the reasons for sticking to their plan were this.
We feel like what we did is good for us. It meets the coastal standards, and that's what should be approved.
Now, to be clear, you were formerly with the California Coastal Commission. What changes are you seeing in how the agency is managing its relationships with cities and developers?
Well, in this case, they're actually being quite reasonable with their effort to reach agreement with the city and put in place an updated plan that will be responsive to sea level rise and other changes. So, for example, the city has identified in their own adaptation plan certain triggers when the beach widths will get narrow and would require them to take action to address that issue. And the Coastal Commission has said, that's great. We recognize that as a way to do this planning over time. We just want you to put that into the plan so that the statewide interest can also be taken into account. The Coastal Commission has not said anything about putting managed retreat back in the plan or this term. But they are asking that, well, if you're going to identify triggers, we also want you to identify a point where you're actually going to do something when those triggers are hit.
But what can the commission do, Charles, when a city says, say, maybe refuses to make any changes that the commission is okay with? Do they have teeth to make cities comply?
Well, unfortunately, the law does not have a required update of plans, and so we've long recognized that for any issue, not just sea level rise, you need to have a plan that's up to date. Otherwise, it's not effective. In this case, if the city doesn't accept what the commission is suggesting, then they'll still have their old plan in place, and it's much more likely that in the future, if someone proposes a development, let's say a redevelopment of a house or a new development somewhere, that development would be subject to challenge and appeal to the Coastal Commission, and that will be a problem for the development interests. So having an out-of-date plan is not good for anyone.
Signed to Charles Lester, director of the Ocean and Coastal Policy Center at UC Santa Barbara. The city is suggesting that the commission is coming down really hard on them and making a one-size-fits-all approach. Again, this is Councilman Warden.
Kind of forcing down from above, and to some extent that's what's going on in some of these suggested changes, and it just doesn't work for us.
But the suggested changes were partly a collaboration between both parties. Charles, what's your take on this, on where this all stands right now?
My take on what the Coastal Commission is saying in this case is that it's pretty reasonable. Yes, there's a statewide authority there. They have the legal mandate to approve the content of this plan. Again, the commission is not forcing any sort of managed retreat into this plan. They're merely saying, look, we want there to be meaningful action related to these triggers. We want you to require that people have information and notice that these particular shoreline properties are inherently risky. That seems to make good sense for all Californians.
And it feels, though, as if Del Mar's decisions and its negotiations with the commission will set maybe a precedent for the state that could send waves up and down the coast in terms of how public lands are managed. I'm wondering, Charles, should additional policies be put in place to maybe be a little more clear about the expected changes on our coast due to climate change?
What happens here could set a precedent for the concept, for example, that triggers or thresholds of resource impact are important to monitor. And when you hit those thresholds, you should take meaningful action in coordination with the state. But the specific action you should take may vary or depend. I think the important precedent that could be set here is that Del Mar could really lead the way for how local governments can be responsive and anticipate adaptation needs in a way that helps the community and helps the state.
Yeah, it does feel a little combative, though. And at the end of the day, I mean, it's people's homes, and we've been told over and over again that a home is someone's castle. Is there a better way to handle these kinds of negotiations, or is it just climate change is too much of a big issue to be nice about?
Well, you know, hopefully there is a better way and that we can all keep improving how we talk to each other and how we work through planning processes and what tend to be sometimes overly legalistic processes. I do think there's a need for everybody to think about how we can do that better. And unfortunately, we need to do that because climate change is a serious matter. It's bringing significant changes. And unfortunately, it's bringing changes in some cases that can't be avoided and that homeowners or property owners and people who care about resources are just going to have to come to terms with. But we need to figure out how to adapt and help people in those situations in a way that's productive for the community and the state.
That's Charles Lester, director of the Ocean and Coastal Policy Center at UC Santa Barbara. Charles, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, if you ever thought to yourself, my rent is too darned high, or maybe scream those words out loud in anger, then keep it tuned right here because soon you might be getting some relief from rising rents. A bill is close to getting made into law that'll cap increases and raise the bar on reasons for evictions. Thing is, a lot of landlords are not too thrilled. Find out what the author of the bill thinks when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Governor Gavin Newsom will sign a bill into law about 20 minutes from now that's meant to give some relief to struggling renters. The signing ceremony comes as Newsom kicks off his statewide rent and housing tour in Oakland. The law will put a statewide cap on how much landlords can raise rents each year and requires them to have a just cause for eviction. In some cases, landlords will even have to pay for tenants to relocate. But some landlords and their lawyers are already planning to find ways around the law. We wanted to ask the bill's author about that, California Assemblyman David Chu. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so give us a little background on this bill. How did it come about, and what will it mean for Californians who are struggling to pay rent?
California is in the midst of the worst housing crisis in our state's history. We have the highest home prices, eviction levels, rent prices, and levels of homelessness. And unfortunately, we have millions of California tenants who are one rent increase away from an eviction or from homelessness. This bill was a response to trying to stabilize the situation and provide some predictability to tenants on what rent increases might look like at a time we've been hearing about 50%, 100%, even 200% rent increases. So the bill has two halves to it. One part of the bill would protect tenants from egregious rent gouging by establishing a rent cap of the consumer price index plus 5%, which is roughly around 8 to 9% a year. The other half of the bill would require that a landlord provide a reason if you're about to be evicted, because right now, in most parts of the state, you can be evicted for no reason whatsoever. And so we have too many tenants who are being evicted for arbitrary, discriminatory, or predatory reasons. And we wanted to provide some predictability for tenants in those instances.
About the eviction part of this, already landlords are arming themselves with lawyers to try and get around this. LA Times reported that a prominent attorney, Dennis Block, has urged landlords to issue eviction notices to tenants who pay low rent or make what he calls a frivolous request before this law goes into effect. Assemblyman, what's your response to this?
Well, unfortunately, landlords have always outgunned tenants in the court system. The vast majority of landlords already have lawyers. They're lawyered up, whereas tenants often don't have lawyers, so that really hasn't changed. There is an aspect of our law that says that as of January 1st, the rent that you pay as of the beginning of next year can't be more than CPI plus 5% of whatever your rent was in March of this year. So while we hopefully are not going to hear of too many landlords who are trying to really jack up the rent because of this, if it does happen, there are protections about that. But from our perspective, landlords are pushing the rents up as much as the market can bear. And what we're trying to do with this bill is to give tenants some predictability in those rent increases while also giving landlords a fair rate of return. CPI plus 5% or 8% is plenty of headroom to make profit, but it gives some predictability to tenants to not be facing egregious rent increases.
Now, one of our own producers got a notice saying that he needed to re-sign his lease or get out before the law goes into effect January 1st. He knows what's going on. He covers this issue all the time. But what do you tell Californians who maybe are not watching the politics of this so closely?
Well, I think it's important for all tenants to be aware of what the law is, which should always be the case. But right now in the state of California, there are very few protections for millions of California tenants. And this bill would provide protections for 8 million tenants, really for the first time, and they would be some of the strongest renter protections in the country.
Now to the rent cap part of this, is this rent control?
You know, I do not think about it as rent control. I will tell you, I represent the city of San Francisco, where we have true rent control. And by that, our rents are capped to a fraction of inflation. So the real value of your rent does not increase over time. Whereas with the rent gouging law that is about to get signed, rents would be capped above the consumer price index. So your rent could actually move up faster than inflation. So really, it's a rent cap against rent gouging as opposed to rent control, which really maintains your rents in real terms to be relatively flat.
So, Assemblyman, when you imagine the renter that will stand to benefit the most, what kind of person are you imagining?
You know, it is literally millions of Californians. It's everyone. It's seniors, it's families, it's low-income folks, and it's middle-class folks from every walk of life in every corner of the state. No one has been immune to what's happening. And our hope is we're going to be stabilizing the situations for an estimated 8 million Californians.
When it comes to the landlord end of things, you mentioned how you feel there's room for landlords to make a profit, but landlords fall into different categories. You got big investment firms, Wall Street companies, but there are also mom and pop landlords who maybe have a rental property to help them with retirement. What's going to stop them from not pushing rent increases to the max when this bill goes into effect?
Well, I'll say a few things about that. First, our law does exempt landlords of tenants living in single-family homes or in owner-occupied duplexes, so we're not impacting the smaller mom-and-pop shops. And we believe that the market will dictate where the rent should go. If a landlord tries to push it up too high, depending on the market, if we hit a recession or otherwise rents go down, we don't expect rent gouging to hopefully continue. But again, our law is put in place to provide some modicum of protections where tenants have no protections at all today.
Now, so once this law does go into effect at the start of next year, what will the state be able to do to enforce tenants' rights here?
So like any landlord-tenant right, it would be enforced privately by individuals who hopefully know what their rights are. And if a landlord is violating those rights, they would do what they would do in any other circumstance involving landlord-tenant law. They would need to get an attorney to make sure that their rights are enforced.
That's California Assemblyman David Chu. He joined us to talk about the bill he authored that puts a statewide cap on rent increases. Assemblyman, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now let's get some local reaction to news from abroad. The Turkish military is preparing to invade northern Syria following President Trump's announcement that he would pull U.S. troops from the region. The policy change would mean the U.S. abandoning Kurdish allies who have been leading the fight against ISIS. And it's drawing condemnation from L.A.'s Kurdish community, as KPCC's Aaron Schrank reports.
Amir Sharifi is a Kurdish human rights advocate who lives in the West Hills area. He says Trump's decision comes as a shock.
This is one of the greatest betrayals of the century. Not that Kurds are not used to such betrayals.
The Kurds are a stateless ethnic group whose population is split into four zones across Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Turkey's President Erdogan has long threatened to invade Kurdish Syria, which is defended by local militias. President Trump argues it's time for the U.S. to pull out. But Kurdish-American Lukman Barwari from Thousand Oaks fears things could turn ugly.
A ground battle would turn the region into another Vietnam, basically, because the Kurds will defend themselves. They will certainly fight for what they have gained.
The Kurdish fight isn't just about ISIS. The Kurds have established a self-governed enclave they call Rojava in northern Syria. Millions live in communes in a revolutionary experiment based on direct democracy, feminism, and ecology. River O'Mahony Hag of Woodland Hills volunteered as a combat medic for the Kurdish militia in 2016. He worries some of his friends there will die if Trump follows through.
If he pulls the troops out, he's going to betray everything we stand for as Americans. It's going to be carnage.
Facing backlash from fellow Republicans, President Trump has been tweeting mixed messages on Syria policy. Kurdish Americans are praying for a reversal. I'm Aaron Schrank.
With so many devastating and destructive fires all over California the last few years, it seems like we can't ever get through much of the calendar without running over an anniversary date of one of them. 2 years ago was a Tubbs fire in Northern California. Nearly four dozen casualties, tens of thousands of acres burned, and thousands of homes just gone. Coming up, we're going to hear from a Santa Rosa resident who lost pretty much everything in that fire. His story's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. It was 2 years ago today that the Tubbs Fire broke out in the Northern California community of Santa Rosa. 44 people died, nearly 37,000 acres burned, 6,200 homes destroyed. Brian Fees was one of the many people who lost his home that day, and he chronicled that experience in the graphic memoir, A Fire Story. He shared it with us a few months ago, so on this rather solemn anniversary, we thought we would bring it out of the archives.
My wife and I were asleep. We'd gone to bed at about 11 o'clock, and my wife woke up about 1:15 when the power went out. The clicking of the clock on the nightstand woke her up. So she got up, she looked outside. We didn't see flames. We saw an orange glow in the sky that almost looked like a sunset. Except, of course, it was 1:30 in the morning. We saw smoke, very thick smoke like fog, blowing sideways, very unnaturally, very eerily. And we heard a dull, muffled roar in the distance, punctuated with these little pops and kabooms of explosions that we figured out only days later were probably propane tanks and things like that exploding as the fire came toward us at 60 miles an hour. We had about 15 minutes to pack as much as we could of our most important things in the dark. Running around the house with flashlights, we got important papers, we got wedding photos, we got baby pictures, we got a little bit of art that was on the wall, but left behind, you know, a lifetime of memories and treasures. I'd lived in Santa Rosa my entire life, more or less. Moved there when I was 12 years old, went to high school there, met my wife when I went away to college, but we came back to start a family and careers in Santa Rosa, raised my daughters there to adulthood. It's my hometown. It's So eerie and devastating to see something so familiar, something you know so well, change so suddenly overnight. It's just the most disorienting feeling I can imagine. Even as I was walking back into my neighborhood the morning after the fire to see what was left, I didn't know that our neighborhood had been destroyed, so I walked back in to try to see what was there. The landmarks were gone. The buildings, the trees, everything was gone. Street signs survived, but I didn't even trust them because they seemed to be out of context. They were wrong. They were in the wrong places, pointing the wrong directions. Even as I was walking into our neighborhood the morning after the fire, I was trying to make sense of the scene. I was obviously devastated that my house and everything in my house was gone. But there was a small part of my brain watching me watch that and saying, this is a story you have to tell. Pay attention to what you're seeing. Take pictures of what you're seeing because you're going to have to tell this story. I knew I was in the middle of this extraordinary event. The day after the fire, I went to a supermarket 20 miles away, and I bought things I needed. I bought shoes, I bought socks, I bought shirts, and I bought rudimentary art supplies. I bought a tablet of bad paper and some Sharpie pens and some highlighter markers to begin telling this story. And I drew 18 pages in about 3.5-4 days. I wrote as fast as I could. I drew as fast as I could. I put it online because that's how one casts one story to the world these days, and it went viral. Something like 700,000 people read that story on my blog within a couple of weeks. And from that, other things happened, including the graphic novel. What I tried to do with the graphic novel, the graphic memoir version of A Fire Story, is I wanted to tell my story, including the small intimate moments between my wife and me, or the story about how I realized I had three keys on my key ring that didn't open anything anymore, or my garage door opener would never work again. Moments like that that kind of show the confusion that follows an event like this. Fire survivors sometimes call it ash brain. Some lessons I took away from this. Some are very practical and some are a little more philosophical. Very practical, study your insurance policy and know what's in your insurance policy, because you will be surprised if you ever need to use it. I would say if somebody ever tells you to evacuate your house, believe them. Assume it's for real. Take all the things you want to have for the rest of your life, because you may never get another chance. It's one of those events that divides your life into before and after. Everything in my life from now on will always be before the fire and after the fire.
That was Brian Fees talking about losing his home to the Tubbs Fire 2 years ago today. He chronicled the story in his graphic memoir, A Fire Story, released earlier this year. Take Two first aired this story in March. All right, an update on the impeachment inquiry. The White House sent a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, 8 pages long, saying it will not participate in their, quote, illegitimate and unconstitutional impeachment inquiry. The White House claims that the way Democrats have handled the proceedings have run roughshod over congressional norms and also the president's due process rights. We'll have more on this on KPCC when NPR's All Things Considered begins at 4 o'clock, so make sure you stay tuned. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.